Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Michael, Mo, Tim, and the occasional guest discussing analytics issues of the day and periodically using explicit language while doing so. Find them on the web at analyticshour.io and on Twitter at analyticshour. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 160. You know, most of us drive around in our cars without ever thinking about the horsepower to each wheel or the fuel to oxygen ratio as you move up to the gears. And well, that's because for most drivers, performance is just kept within a certain threshold. But jump over to car enthusiasts trying to eke out maximum performance out of their vehicles, and suddenly you have laptops full of data and dyno machines and purpose-specific tuning for engines, and every aspect of the vehicle, its engine, tire, suspension, etc., is being brought together and measured to achieve the best possible result. What if in the field of analytics, we never looked under the hood of our performance engines? Well, when we tried to hit the accelerator, we might find out that our acceleration was sluggish or non-existent. Worse, we wouldn't have the first clue where to look for the problem. What we're talking about is tracking our data so that our analytics platforms can perform. For any business, our data and analytics capability has to be at peak performance at all times, which means we need to be able to understand where our systems are limited, what we can do about it, and how to fix it. Hey, Mo, do you know anything about the Aussie burnout scene at all?
I know a little bit about how to avoid it. A lovely festival in Canberra called Summernats, which I used to do my best to get out of town for.
It's so strange that there is this connection of data between car enthusiasts and data enthusiasts, and yet maybe culturally we don't always align so well. Tim, you ever get under the hood and tune any of your vehicles?
Occasionally. Funny enough, I wound up just connecting to with a guy who used to work for me years ago who was an autocross guy. And literally out of the blue, we had a little bit of an exchange about that. But I think this might have been one of your longest windups to a topic in the history of the show.
Yeah.
Well, I do watch a lot of YouTube videos about cars and auto car tuning. So, yeah.
I got to make the link to analytics.
Well, it just sort of seemed to fit because that's what we're talking about. But we do need a guest, somebody who can kind of make this connection a little stronger and dig a little deeper into what's holding back analytics performance at most companies. So Bar Moses is the CEO of Monte Carlo, a data reliability and observability company. She's a member of the Forbes Technology Council, was previously a VP at Gainsight and a management consultant at Bain & Company. And today she is our guest. Welcome to the show, Bar.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great you could be here. So, I mean, does that analogy hold up for you? In part, you know, that's more of a personal question.
No, for sure. At Monte Carlo, we're big Formula One fans over here, so definitely resonates.
Yeah, that's another place that's awash with data, right? Formula One. I mean, oh my gosh. But yeah, like let's maybe start with just breaking down data reliability and observability more generally, because I think that'll just be a good jumping off point to kind of what that is. And, you know, it's not something that I think gets talked about a lot in the analytics industry. So it might be good for our audience to just get a little bit of a background.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the concept of sort of, we kind of call it data downtime, if you will, as a corollary to application downtime. And I think it really starts out from sort of this change that we're seeing in the last sort of decade or so, where in the past, applications were really driven by logic largely. And today, more and more applications are driven by the data actually that's feeding them. And so when companies are using applications or data, whether to make decisions or to operate their companies, the importance of that data being accurate and being reliable becomes obviously way more important. The other thing that we're seeing is that more and more people are using data in real time for sort of real time decision making. And so in the past, you know, if you had just a handful of people looking at sort of small amounts of data, maybe once a quarter or so, you could really get away with some like issues in the data or data arriving late because you had a lot of time to sort of make up for it, right? But today, you know, you have like organizations where literally everyone from marketing to customer success to sales to product using data to make decisions, you can't really afford to continue to have sort of inaccurate data at the rate that we've been used to. And so I think because of that, this issue is becoming more and more prominent. I really like your example of a car, actually, because I feel like what we're doing right now, sort of the car, how you think about performance, what we're doing right now is kind of crazy. It's as if we sort of, you know, we're putting together, we're, you know, if you think about like a car sort of factory, we're kind of like putting together the car and all the parts. But then the only time that we know if it's like working is when we actually drive the car like 60 miles per hour, then suddenly like all the windows sort of burst open and like, you know, just everything kind of blows up at 60 miles per hour. And you're like, well, if only we would have like checked things upstream or like put some, you know, put some mechanics in place to make sure that the inputs are accurate or that the process is good, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Is it not to belabor an analogy and encourage Michael by any stretch, but I grew up as the child of an engineer, and he religiously, every time we filled up the gas, he would put in, you know, the date, the miles, and how much gas he put in. And then he would periodically go back and actually calculate the miles per gallon, right? This was the 70s. And I thought that's just what you did. I thought everybody did that. I didn't realize he was kind of, and I was like, when I figured out, I was like, why do you do that? He's like, well, if the mileage starts to decline, that could be a symptom that there's something wrong with the vehicle. I don't recall. I think he would actually get around to calculating the mileage maybe like once a year. So back to your kind of the frequency of it. And for the first, I don't know, 10 years that I was an adult, I was diligently tracking it as well and recognized that I never was actually checking the mileage. Whereas now when you have that, you're getting the mileage that you're getting kind of in real time. If you'd say, gee, I'm starting to drive along. Well, I guess now you just have sensors in the car that say you have a low tire or something. But
now you make so much sense as a human. Like I understand you on a whole new level.
I'm sorry.
I'm still stuck back at Barr thinks my analogy was good. So
Well, thanks everyone. See you next time.
My dad actually just visited me last week and he was driving on he was on a 5-hour drive and he called me to say that he ran out of gas. There might be another lesson here too.
So Barr, with this, I don't know the word to frame it, but this topic or people starting to care about observability, where have you found, like, what areas of the business are really driving this and making companies focus on it? Is it coming from the data teams? Is it, you know, coming from the execs? Like,
yeah. So maybe we can. So there's a couple of different forces here, I think, to your point. And again, I also clarify, what does observability mean in this context? So I think it's not an obvious sort of term that we use today, right? So starting from sort of the pain, right? Sort of data downtime or data being wrong, to your question, like who actually feels that in the business, right? Is that something that like execs feel or sort of engineers or data people? And the interesting thing about data downtime is it's kind of like that sentence, like, you know, I don't remember how it goes, but something like failure has like many parents and success has like one or something like that, right? There's something around that. I'm probably misquoting it. But I think the thing with like data downtime, data problems is that kind of like, there's no one that really wants to take sort of responsibility for it, but everybody feels it, from kind of like the engineers who are responsible for like setting up the pipelines to, you know, the data engineers, maybe kind of munging data or data scientists, to product managers, all the way to marketers who are using data in their marketing campaigns, and executives who are looking at reports. So when data goes bad, actually, like each of those folks might be feeling that. It might sort of, it is top of mind for them. The question is, who's actually responsible for resolving it, right? And so what we see from our customers is that oftentimes this topic comes from the tension between these organizations, when it is actually oftentimes the data team that's the last to find out about these issues. It's the data consumers that catch them, right? So how often does it happen to you that you're like working on something or like, you know, starting your morning on Monday, and then you get a phone call from, you know, the CMO saying like, what's going on with sort of this marketing campaign, or what's going on with this report that I'm looking at, and just like throws your day and does this entire kind of, you know, race to find out like who's responsible for that pipeline, what exactly broke, pinging, you know, if you're lucky, 10 different people on Slack, and, you know, and figuring that out. And so in that tension, I think, is where sort of this problem comes up. And then the question is, how do you solve it, right? The traditional ways that we've solved it are no longer sufficient. So in the past, we could basically say like garbage in, garbage out, right? Because there was one point in which we ingest the data and that's it. So we just need to make sure that like the data that we ingest is clean and we can call it a day. But today, our architecture is way more sophisticated. Data can break anywhere along those lines. And that's where observability comes in. Observability helps you get visibility into the health of your system and see it in real time wherever sort of data breaks.
But do you think people got complacent along the way? Because that scenario you described, I sat here nodding and nodding and nodding because that's literally happens a couple times a week at most organizations I've worked in. And like stakeholders start to get to the stage where they're like, oh, did the data warehouse build like work this morning because all my numbers look off? And like stakeholders start to just be like, oh, it's going to happen a few times. Like they just start to expect it. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that's a healthy thing. It just means people become complacent about expecting data to fail.
Totally. I think there's a couple of things. One, 100% people have become complacent for sure. You know, it's really hard that you would talk to someone and they haven't experienced that. Also, by the way, it's really kind of like unsexy to try to solve that, right? People are not excited about trying to like, you know, solve. They want to build something that's like core to their business, right? And so it's kind of easy to get complacent with that, right? I call BS on that a little bit. I think, you know, in today's world, if we really want to get our organizations to be data driven, like we can't cut that slack for ourselves anymore. We've been able to do it so far, but if we're headed in the direction that we want to be headed, we're not going to be able to do that anymore. We're just getting too many people, too many eyes on the data, and it's just its impact on business is becoming immense. And so because of that, we have to rethink how we're doing this.
It does seem like, well, one, I feel like the digital analytics industry has taken kind of a, companies have cropped up with solving one little point solution, and I frankly think not solving it well, so I won't name the three or four platforms. Like, we'll just crawl your site and make sure the raw data collection is happening. But that's my big question is, you describe it as a system, all of those pipes, and the pipes are running from the raw data into maybe the tool. And then there's a pipe from the tool into a data lake. And then there's a pipe from the data lake into three different data marts. And so by the time somebody has found a problem, but it sounds like you're saying, well, you do kind of have to look at the whole system. By the time there's a problem, the troubleshooting, which does tend to suck, although a lot of, it does feel like organizations tend to have like the common breakpoints, and they're like, well, did, you know, was it the data warehouse load again? Mm-hmm. But then that also winds up competing with the people wanting to invest in that is the same as the challenges of technical debt that companies wind up with, saying we could spend $100,000 doing this cool new feature, or we could spend $100,000 getting our house in order, which seems like it could be just refactoring stuff to remove technical debt, which just makes everything more robust and pays dividends in a hard, unseen way down the road. But is data observability also wind up in that? Say, well, we could spend $100,000 getting a really well instrumented observability process platform system in place. And people look at that and say, yeah, but I want to go chase the cool new feature that I can go talk about. Are those similar? And I guess, do you run into those challenges? Is that where people push back?
Yeah, for sure. It's such a great question. I think going back to the sort of corollary for application a little bit, you know, sort of if you think about the best correlation here from observability in the sort of for software engineering, where this is a very well understood space, the best, you know, the best solution or kind of an example would be like New Relic or AppDynamics or Datadog, right? And you don't really see an engineering team today operate without something like that. And you're right, there are some organizations who may choose their own homegrown solutions for that and invest in sort of what you'd call, I don't know, like application or tech debt more generally, right? But there aren't that many, right? Oftentimes you just use something that's off the shelf. Observability in data is new, right? It's not as well understood. And you know, I think we're going to get to a point where every data team will have something like New Relic, but for your data. And I actually agree with you that it doesn't always make sense to build it in-house. It's probably better to do off the shelf. I think in terms of kind of your questions on like data debt and whether to invest in that or not, that is 100% something that we see a lot across the board. It's very hard to justify kind of investing in data debt. I think people also don't you know, have this like negative reaction to sort of investing in debt versus investing in the next cool feature, to your point. And so I think the struggle for data organizations is how do they justify their activities and their investments, right? How do they tie that to real sort of impact on the business? And I think observability in that perspective is easier to tie because it allows your organization to actually move faster and to focus on those new features because you have something else that kind of you can rely on to make sure your data can be trusted.
So imagine it is a similar process of like a business case that you would do for anything else. Like I know, for example, when our data warehouse goes down for a week, that means our attribution model has failed. That means our entire marketing team don't know what they've spent or the ROI on that. Like it is actually very quick and easy to put a monetary figure on data failing, but it doesn't always seem like people, I don't know. I feel like sometimes data people are not always great at like making that case. Like, I don't know. I just see it as like any other business case that you would do in the company, right?
Yeah, for sure. So I think in some businesses, to your point, like it's very easy and very clear to like tie that to your point, like, you know, models aren't working or, you know, oftentimes in organizations where data literally is the product, like think about an e-commerce website, right? You know, speaking to a head of data at an e-commerce company, he was telling me like, if the data is wrong in our website, I'd actually prefer that our website would be down. Right? Like, you know, or for example, this large retail company that's moving their parts of the business into e-commerce. And, you know, a common sort of issue is kind of coupon code issues, where you're literally kind of like giving the wrong discounts to customers. You might be overcharging or undercharging on a particular item that you're selling. Like that's real material impact to the business. And so I think for folks who are in data, you know, there it's quite clear, Mo, to your point. I think for companies that are new to the data, potentially just moving to the cloud or kind of figuring out how to use data as kind of a competitive advantage, you know, obviously do more work to kind of figure out the ROI in that case.
I was gonna say, it does seem like the case would be, as you were saying, the organizations that are relying on the data, the automation of dynamically making offers, dynamic personalization, those sorts of things that if you say, okay, that means that this is all the data that's going into that model that is automatically deciding to do things. If this data, if all of a sudden this flatlines, either I have to figure out that my model has to take into account for that and kind of have built-in governance, or I need to have a better kind of systemic solution so that kind of the alerting system will say this is a problem and we'll know to sort of shut stuff down and not be throwing the wrong discounts out or making the wrong offers. So I wonder if it is, whereas if I'm looking at them, if I'm in an organization looking at monthly reports, okay. So yeah, maybe the data was broken for the whole month, but how much are it? It feels like it's more for when there's active use and you need complete data and it needs to be detailed from multiple systems. And if something goes wrong, you're really screwed. That makes for an easier business case to make than and there are more and more companies that are operating there than are operating in the, well, let me look at the monthly report. It comes out 2 weeks into the following month. You're like, yeah, you're probably not quite ready or you've got bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you're looking at your report sort of once a quarter, maybe you're not even a public company, so you're not reporting on it to anyone. It's just internal. You have a lot of time and a lot of people. You know, I talk, you know, folks in those categories typically tell me, yeah, we have often like between 3 to 4 people who need to look at every report before it goes out. So you can afford to have, you know, like 3 to 4 sets of eyes on a report to do that. To your point, like the minute that it becomes, you know, either it's reported to the street or reported to the board, or it's financial data that actually is being used as part of your models or part of your product, you know, whether it's to sort of value, you know, value a home or provide a loan or, you know, decide on discount, et cetera, like any of that sort of uses that are more real time.
I mean, I often use this kind of thinking as a marker for where an organization is in their analytics. Like maturity is kind of an overused word, but it's indicative of like, is this an impactful program or set of things that we're doing? Or is it sort of, we're just playing like the same song we try to see everybody else playing because we think we're supposed to be doing it. And so like, if you're an analyst in that kind of an organization or in an organization, a really good test of like, does my work matter? And do I have an exciting future here is basically how this kind of stuff is being treated. So just a pro tip for everybody. If they don't care about this stuff, they probably don't care about anything else you do either.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
Mara, do you see typically with companies, so for context, the company I work at, I don't feel like we're totally shitting the bed in this space. Like, I feel like,
is that where the bar is set?
You're only partially shitting the
bed. I feel like, you know, we have a pretty good data team. People generally do care about data quality and like the build breaking and stuff like that. All of the code that we release has tests that built in place to make sure we know if things are going to break before they're released in production. We've just changed our whole data warehouse build from a daily to a weekly because we've intentionally are now trying to go through that. Like, we want to release once a week. We want everything to be tested in dev incrementally first, and then we build rather than like at the moment where our build fails a couple times a week because someone pushes something and we haven't checked it. So I feel like we're really doing the like crawl and then, you know, walk and then run journey that probably most companies go through. But I just wonder, in your experience, do you feel like most people do that, or do most companies go from crawling to running and or like straight to a tool? Or do you feel like people try and solve this internally, they find that they don't get the results they want, and then they move to tooling? Like, what do you see in the market?
Yeah. So I'll share with you a little bit about how actually sort of why, what got me interested in this space and how we got into this. So actually I was at a company where I was responsible for sort of internal customer data and analytics. And we started becoming more data driven as a company. And so we started becoming more sophisticated in how we're using data. And we sort of had, you know, maybe a similar situation too, where I felt like, you know, our team is good. We care about data quality. You know, we're not completely shitting the bed, to your point. And yet data downtime sort of happened, right? And I asked myself, like, am I crazy? Is the world crazy? Like, should I just, you know, kind of like accept this as is? Like, what's going on? And actually what I did was I ended up sort of speaking with over 150 or so organizations, ranging from very small startups to large companies like Netflix and Uber and Facebook, and really, you know, folks kind of invested a lot in data as an organization, and asked them, like, what, first of all, is this happening to you all? You know, am I the crazy person here, or does this actually happen? And two, what are you all doing about this? And I learned so much from that. Actually, I will not use the word maturity, but we put together a maturity curve based on sort of these learnings, where we basically like plotted people, or plotted organizations, where they are across this curve in terms of kind of how proactive they are in addressing these. And I would say that almost all organizations who are serious about their data find themselves treating this or addressing this problem in some shape or form. It could be in the very early stage where they're very reactive about it. So just whenever there's a fire drill, like there's like this SWAT team, everybody just like jumps on it, to the very kind of other end where they actually like Netflix, for example, invested a lot in sort of anomaly detection and different observability sort of features that they've built in quite a more scalable solution, if you will. And then in the middle, there's a couple other stages where folks, you know, might find themselves on that journey. And so to your point on like, what are some of the things that folks do along the way? Testing is definitely a big one that comes up, right? And that I think is very important to do. I will add that similarly to how in software engineering, testing is one component, but you still have monitoring and observability. I really think they go hand in hand, right? So it's very hard to specify sort of tests for everything that you sort of, you know, everything under the sun, if you will. And so you want to augment that testing with strong monitoring and observability to help catch things that, you know, you probably might not catch, similar to how you do in software engineering.
So how does the monitor, I mean, you mentioned kind of at the end of the curve, anomaly detection. I mean, I can see in theory, you're saying, well, if we just put taps at all of the critical spots, and then we look at all of the data, and then we just look at all the points and say, this used to have 500 unique values, and all of a sudden it's coming in with two. I mean, is it kind of conceptually like you've mapped out the whole system and you figured out the points where you're going to observe, and your observing is looking for anomalies? Or is there like, how, I guess, back to the defining observability, what does that really mean?
Great question. So first of all, I'll start by saying I do think that in order to solve this, it has to be end to end. So it has to work with your data stack, whatever that is, including sources, data lake, data warehouse, and BI or machine learning, right? Sort of to simplify that. I think a strong observability solution is one that connects end to end to your existing stack. So it doesn't actually require you to replace anything, doesn't require you to, you know, write in a specific language, literally just, you know, connects to your existing stack. The other thing that's important is that I think, you know, there needs to be a strong focus on security. You know, when you're connecting to, you know, this is kind of like the heart and soul of an organization. And so you need to have a strong sort of security first architecture for whatever you're connecting to your data. And then to your point, like, what does it actually mean? Like, what are we observing on Earth, right? we ask ourselves the same question, right? Like in software engineering, what you're observing is very straightforward. It's very well understood, right? You know, whether it's performance or storage or whatever it is that you're measuring. But in data, it's not clear to us. We have different ways of thinking about that. And so what we did is we actually sort of compiled sort of from these conversations that I mentioned we had and from our work, we compiled all the different reasons why data breaks. And at first, you know, we were like, data can break for so many, you know, millions of different reasons. Like, what are we going to do? How do we get started? Right. But actually, we were surprised to see that everybody thinks that they're a snowflake and everybody is a snowflake. But there are some common patterns that we can match here. And, you know, this isn't to say that like with a great observability solution, your data will be 100% accurate. I don't think that data will never be 100% accurate. But, you know, in the pursuit of accuracy, you can get pretty damn close to excellence. And so, you know, we sort of came up with, based on kind of the work that we did, we consolidated all of these findings into sort of five key pillars of data observability. And from our experience, if you are systematically sort of instrumenting and monitoring and analyzing these five key pillars, then you have a strong sense of the health of your data and can have that confidence. And those five pillars, the first is freshness, which, you know, you sort of mentioned, Mo, that, you know, at some point, like your data warehouse was down. That happens all the time, right? You're dependent on third-party data oftentimes or third-party infrastructure that, you know, might not be updating your data. And so having a sense of the freshness, like how up-to-date are your tables or your data assets is super critical. The second is volume. So pretty straightforward, like, you know, the completeness of your data tables. The third is distribution. So this is, Tim, to your point, you were asking, you know, I have a field and, you know, it's typically between X, Y ranges. And today it's in very different ranges, right? It could also just be, you know, other statistics about the data, like percentage null values, for example. You know, if you are used to having 0% null values in your credit card field, and suddenly you have 70% null values in your credit card field, then like, obviously something is wrong. You're not charging your customers. You need to get on that. And then the fourth is schema. So schema is sort of, you think of like an audit log of like, who makes changes to your data and when? We talked about the different personas in data and across sort of that end to end, right? So who's making changes to your data lake? And who's making changes to a table that depends on that in your data warehouse? And who's making changes to like the 10 other tables that are related to it? What kind of changes? And then the last one is lineage. So lineage really helps us answer questions like, where exactly did the data break? How did it affect downstream dependencies? Maybe there's a table that's not getting updated, but there's literally no one watching, literally no one using that data. So who cares, right? But if there's a table that, you know, this is like a sort of basic example, but if there's a table that gets updated 3 times an hour and, you know, your entire C-suite is using it every morning at 7 a.m. and you need to make sure that data is updated by then, that's probably a sort of a data asset that you should have sort of more monitoring and more checks on.
Those five pillars are amazing. I love it. It's like a really clean way of thinking about it. But so on the point of lineage, would you put in place different practices for, say, like the table that you mentioned that the C-suite used every morning at 7? Like, there would be different standards of observability and monitoring applied to that versus the table that, you know, old mate built 6 months ago that they've never looked at.
Yeah, I think there needs to be different levels of monitoring and different levels of observability and also different actions taken, right? So for example, if there's a data asset, if there's, let's say there's kind of like, you know, we can take a specific example, like a fintech company that has, you know, a report that the executive team is looking at every morning at 7 a.m. and it relies on sort of thousands of different sources. Right. So you need to make sure that like 6:50 a.m., all of those sources of like street, you know, process the data and everything is up to date. And if anything goes wrong, you want the right person in the organization to be notified ASAP, the actions that you will take will be different. Whereas if, you know, some table that's not being used at all, perhaps maybe you'd want to know about that, but maybe you actually can deprecate the table and not use it at all, right? Because if we have so many copies of tables, right? So maybe you can actually like make better use of that.
So does this start, and I've gone through this with a few clients and sort of found what seemed to be the most effective way to get at it, like getting an organization to even wrap their heads around what the data flows and the systems are, and the, like, you can't, like, lineage can't start. You can follow one point all the way back through, but are you trying to start by saying we kind of have to understand the whole system, which I'll say the way that a colleague of mine was like, it's a network diagram. You've got nodes or your data sources and edges or the flows between them. And that is a very simple schema. You have a table of your nodes and you have a table of your edges, and you can put metadata against that. And we've done that with multiple clients where we get diagrams in PowerPoint where they're like, well, this is this part of the system, and this, nobody's figured out how to actually wrap their head around the entire infrastructure. And then we wind up saying, well, the first thing you have to do to shore this up is actually capture the whole system. And it seems like that would be the, like, do you have to actually get a system data system map, which is going to be dynamic and fluid and changing, before you start on this? Or do you start with a, let's find a critical, what the executive team looks at, and kind of work from there, and then kind of expand out with the different kind of monitoring and observability? Or is it, it depends, because you were a consultant, you were at Bain, so, you know.
Yeah, actually just recently wrote a blog post called Metadata is Useless. So I'll refer to that in particular. it's a little bit strong, but I think in the past, we had a tendency of collecting a lot of data and then not always making use of it. You know, we just had like tons of data. And I think we're a little bit at risk of doing the same thing with metadata. So we're just collecting a lot of it, and I'll sort of include lineage under sort of the category of metadata. And so, yeah, we see, you know, folks kind of invest actually years in putting together this map, like manual hard work, which is, you know, sort of a serious undertaking for an organization to map, to your point, sort of the infrastructure end to end. I think those, you know, are oftentimes very important for kind of compliance and financial reasons and all of that. In sort of, you know, the thing that I've sort of seen work best, to your point, is when metadata is applied to a particular use case. So we can say, we can actually start with a particular area that's either driving sort of a product, a digital product, or to your point, is being used by folks in the organization to make decisions, and then use lineage to help drive the question of like, where is the data coming from and can I trust it, right? So rather than generating a map that's, you know, you look at maybe once a year, or you look at and you like need to update, let's put that map to use, right? So let's generate a lineage that's actually dynamic, that updates automatically when someone deletes or adds a table. The lineage should be updating automatically without someone having to manually add that or edit that. And let's also marry that with information that helps us make decisions about the data. So for example, looking at a table, knowing that it's not up to date, and then using lineage to understand what are the implications of that downstream. So I'm really sort of, I really believe in applying metadata, lineage, you know, whatever you'd like, for a very, very particular use case and a very, very narrow need for data consumers.
As opposed to the glorious, wouldn't it be nice if we just had all this? I'm sure if we had all of this, it would take us 5 years to get there, but man, then it would be so powerful. And it's like, well, you'll actually never get all of it. And then nobody remembers what it's supposed to be used for. And it's already out of date anyway. So that was a colossal waste of time. I like it.
Okay. You got it. Yes.
And oh, by the way, we were collecting it wrong this whole time. We can't even get the thing we wanted.
And I forgot why we even started this to begin with.
Yeah. And also everyone involved quit 3 years ago.
Exactly.
Bar, I wanted to talk a little bit before we were talking about like notifications and alerts. And I realized that this is an area that engineering has solved fairly well. But just, I'm thinking about it more from the how do we get our data people to have that same mindset, in that if you have too many alerts, people start to ignore them. If you have too many people on the alerts, there's bystander effect and no one takes responsibility for it. Like, what is your kind of best practice recommendation around that to make sure that when there is a really high priority build, you know, it's flagged with the right person and the right action is taken out of it, versus like just getting 20 emails a day being like, something broke, something else broke, something else broke?
Yeah, alert fatigue is a real thing. That in sort of conversations with, in our work, in our conversations, that has come up a lot. Actually, from day one, we've been thinking about that. You know, to your point, I think both, there's definitely a risk of sort of being inundated with information that you actually like might not care about, right? And so the way that we've approached this is in a couple of ways. One is trying to, and this relates a little bit to sort of the question of metadata, but adding sort of context to alerts so that you can quickly decide whether it is important to you or not, right? So to kind of, you know, as an example, you know, if you kind of like set automatically alerts for all of the tables that you ever had, including all of those that are not being used, you're very likely to be bombarded by alerts that you do not care about. But here's the thing. You can actually know automatically without your input. I can tell you which tables are being most used. I can tell you here are the top 10 assets. And you know what? They are being used every day by a large number of people. And so you probably want to know about most changes in these assets, for example. And so that gives us clues or sort of strong hints into what are the parts of the data that you really want to know about. And so that's kind of like the, what I would say, we're really trying to push how much we can automate here and use based on kind of like metadata and statistics and query logs that we can use to inform alerts and to make them more practical. And so there's definitely way more that we can do just by observing your data. That's first of all, you know, looking who's using the data and when and how often, how important it is. And then the second part is there is a component where, you know, Mo, if you like wake up every morning and you use this particular table and, you know, specifically, and you'd like to apply your own kind of custom rule to that for monitoring, that's definitely an important part, right? Like, I don't think we can fully replace people with automation for sure. There's a lot that we can do here. I think we've actually done very little as an industry on this, on sort of the automation of this, but there's definitely sort of always a need for the specificity that people will know about their businesses that we add in.
Is there a way to guard against, or I guess where having when worked with alerts or any sort of anomaly detection and finding like, oh, whatever crude, imperfect kind of system that's doing the monitoring says this is, and maybe it's just looking at Michael likes to talk about how he used to have like a dashboard that he would just look at to see if anything happened. And so you see something that looks like a data issue, like your observability says, hey, something's gone squirrely here. And you think it's a data problem, but the digging to address it actually turns out that the business did make a decision. Gee, our revenue for this whole class of products flatlined. And well, it turns out that whole class of products is no longer being sold, or that whole line of products has a supply issue and it's an inventory. So I've lived through that a few times where it's like, oh, something happened in the data. And I spend, you know, a few hours kind of get to the bottom of it. And what I find out is I just didn't get to the right person who said, oh yeah, we turned that off, or, oh yeah, you know, we stopped doing that. And so I think that would come under the distribution.
My favorite, the engineer who's like, oh, we were doing load testing. Is that something you need to know about?
Yeah. So like that, it seems like that would hit the distribution kind of category where like, oh, this data went wonky, and you start tracing it saying, well, we got to go through the lineage and figure out upstream, where did it go to? And like, we've traced it all the way back to the source. It's a problem. What's going on? And it's like, well, no, it was a business change.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great question. So here's the kicker with observability that we've noticed that I found fascinating is the minute that you start surfacing this information to people, the way that they start thinking about this changes, because now people know that when I'm making a change upstream, you're going to know about that, right? Because I'm tracking kind of schema changes as well. And so if I'm, you know, if there's something that's happening upstream, you're very likely to be known about, to know about this, right? You're also likely going to be more thoughtful about, before making that change, you're going to look at Lineage to see who's relying on this, if there's anyone that's relying on it, because you know that you're going to hear from that person. And so the interesting thing is that the more that you kind of make, you know, I don't like sort of these jargony words, but the more that you make observability self-serve in the organization and actually like share this information, imagine that every person who, you know, is sort of owning a set of reports or data tables or whatever it is, owning parts of, owning some data assets, they actually have information, access to observability information that empowers them to like ask questions earlier. And we actually see sort of the rate of data downtime or data incidents often goes down just because people have awareness of who's relying on the changes that they're making, who might be impacted. And so just by serving that information, that makes a significant impact. And specifically to your question, yes, I agree with you. Oftentimes or sometimes big changes in data might be intentional, right? Like maybe I just, you know, turned off a data source, or maybe we shut down a line of products. Here's the thing. Many times people still want to know about that, right? Because what if the marketing team was still, you know, they still have campaigns in Facebook to publish that line of products that you just deprecated? Well, we'd like to know about that. And so oftentimes, you know, there could be a notification. We're like, yep, confirm this is intentional. You know, we're glad to see that, you know, you turned off the data, so it's not taking up space or something like that.
So, okay, I've got a question. Let's say someone's listening to this podcast and they're like, wow, you're right. Like, we need to get started on this data observability. What are the first steps companies should be taking? So, like, how do they go from zero to, you know, 0.1 in this journey? Aside from the obvious of maybe like buying the product that you're the CEO of, but, you know, like, we'll leave that one out.
Yeah, no worries. I was just going to say, you know, they call Tim up and within 5 minutes, it gets solved. No, I mean, I think, you know, I think there's a number of different things that companies do, right? So first, or what we actually see most often is that folks go through recent issues that they had and then set up specific monitors for that, right? So for example, you know, if schema changes, for example, is something that like lots of people actually like start as a good place, like to just, you know, have awareness of that. The second thing that companies do is often set up some, you know, pretty basic checks, like just look at row counts, right? It's not very effective. It's not the most robust, but that's pretty straightforward, right? You can just look at some sort of monitors like that. That's oftentimes a place where people start. What they kind of, if they decided to invest more in that, then they might start sort of hacking their own solution using some SQL wrappers, or, you know, this could also be just defining SLAs between different organizations, defining SLAs for specific, you know, data assets that are more important that they, you know, they want to hold themselves accountable for. And so actually like start building, you know, reports to track that, right? Like how often does data break and when, and start holding their teams accountable. And then you see sort of teams building more of kind of like they're hacking their solutions. So we really see sort of a wide variety in terms of where you're at. And so in my opinion, what you'd want is have, going back to those five kind of data observability pillars, you think of it as like a, you know, like a spot check for your car. Going back to the car analogy, right? You want to make sure that what you're looking at is a complete set of checks.
Nice. I was just going to say, and Michael, surely that would also depend where you are in the organization. Like, I mean, like one little thing that I do, for example, on my dashboards is I always have the latest date of the data at the top, so that like if the data warehouse didn't run this morning and the date is not yesterday, there's a problem. Like, and then like as soon as the stakeholder sees that the date isn't yesterday or they see it, I straight away know, hey, that's like something little I can do to flag that something's broken. And I mean, that's obviously like the tiniest of little things you can do, but at least then you know, okay, our build failed this morning. That's the first thing I've got to do then is go talk to the data engineering team. Whereas like for the data engineering team, I'm sure there's like a gazillion other checks and steps that they do that I'm not even across.
But no, I mean, that's it fits within the freshness pillar if you leverage that paradigm a little more, which I'm totally going to be using a ton of. Well, I think what you've done really nicely is encapsulated the problem in a very approachable framework that a lot of times it's sort of like, oh yeah, data. And then you don't really have a systematic way to approach it. Like data people aren't necessarily have the mindset of sort of like, oh, an engineering organization who's developed best practices around this. And they've, you know, they've got telemetry data, they've got this other data. We're sort of like, oh yeah, Facebook changed their API again and it broke everything. And well, now what? Yeah. So this is where I feel like that's just like really super helpful.
Yeah. We sort of call it the good pipelines, bad data problem, right? Like we've invested in like awesome infrastructure. We have the best pipelines in the world, but like data is oftentimes not great. Right. And Mo, to your point, actually, that was such a great example because, you know, that sort of first step of looking at freshness at the last stage and at least making sure that that works, yeah. Right? But thinking about it, you probably have like 7 or 8 different, you know, maybe, I don't know, 5 to 10, 20 different steps where freshness could break. And so if you truly wanted to understand whether it's fresh, you had to like look at all of those steps kind of upstream to make sure, which to your point is probably, you know, maybe data engineering, but that's a great first step.
Baby steps for me.
Well, is there a case, and this is another, because from the little tiny point solutions that are in the digital analytics side, where it's the data collection side, I feel like it's perpetually this closing the barn doors after the horses have gotten out. Like something happens, the data breaks, it causes an issue, and they're like, "Oh, we're going to put a monitor in place to make sure we catch that." And it's like, well, because it broke and a few heads rolled, there was already the process was shored way up. So if this had a 5% chance of breaking before and it broke, now it's down to a 0.5% chance of breaking and now you're monitoring it. And so something else is going to break. So it seems like that starting with specific areas, but not saying, I'm not trying to put observability in place for that one specific data field or that one specific thing. I want to kind of solve for that class of things, but not at the point where I'm trying to boil the entire ocean. Like, is that part of the kind of like, if I'm going to put a freshness check in, let me put freshness in multiple places that make sense so that I've kind of got this freshness check in a bunch of areas, not just for, you know, one table. Is that part of the approach, or I'm making this stuff up as we go? So I have no idea if that actually makes sense. It's just where my mind was going.
Yeah, it does make sense. I think that's right. I think oftentimes, I mean, well, taking a step back for a second, you are probably already paying in some shape or form for this problem, right? Whether it's in, you know, you have sort of data issues and it's impacting your business, or you're building it and addressing it in some way, right? So this is costing your organization already. And the question is, how do you want to tackle that? You can start with, you know, doing kind of like sort of a lot of postmortems and, you know, figuring out point solutions, or you can think about a more holistic way to your point and say, let's, you know, focus on the things that one are easy to automate or relatively easy to automate, and that will give us some coverage to start out with so that we don't have to spend our entire time on this. Mm-hmm. And we can focus on other revenue generating things. And you're right. Part of that is looking at some, looking first ways to sort of leverage what we can do automatically in a scalable way, freshness being one of them. And the second is providing more of that coverage versus like very point solutions, because at the end, you know, the freshness of your data or the robustness of your data in a report or, you know, in a model really relies on your data warehouse and your data lake as well.
And I really love the point you made, Bar, about like using data to inform, like you could potentially be like, we're going to do this for the top 10 most important tables or builds or whatever, or 5 or whatever it is. And like, incrementally show that value to the business of like, look, we stopped all this stuff from breaking as often, we've had less downtime. Like for me, sometimes it's even just getting some of the stakeholders that are involved in that data pipeline to realize the impact on the stakeholders. And so sometimes I say to my stakeholders, I'm like, can you go put it in the channel that it broke? Because you need to explain what the consequences of it breaking is, because they're just like, oh, well, it broke again. Like, we'll fix it over the next few days. Whereas, you know, me and the marketers are having like hot flashes. And so I love that idea of like really being able to choose how you roll this out and like show value and then take another step and another step. Like, I think that's a really nice way of thinking about it.
Yeah, it's definitely a part of thinking about how do you empower your data consumers to use data, right? Because if there's this thing where the group of folks who's responsible for generating the data, transforming the data, are often not the same people who are actually using the data. And so there's this gap between that, right? And so bridging that gap and telling someone to like write it in Slack so that they communicate is one great way to bridge that gap. The other is by surfacing information that helps both parties make better decisions about that. That means that the folks who are generating the data and transforming the data needs to know that the changes that they're making are having real business decisions, and the data consumers need to know who to go to and what data they can use.
Excellent. All right. We do have to start to wrap up. This is such a good conversation. I think two reasons why. First is the fact that we're talking about this makes me feel like as analytics people, we're finally growing up into like a real like important industry. Like we're going to like not only use data, but we're going to like try to be adult about it too. So that's really cool. And secondly, I just love, Barr, that you've put the time and work into really conceptualizing this in such a good way. It's like, it's just very obvious. You've really thought deeply about this problem space. So appreciate that.
I was so sure the second one was going to be that it was important because she liked your analogy. And
that's third point.
Just wait till you hear my last call. No, I'm just kidding. I'm joking. Okay, we do. That is a little pointer. One of the things we do like to do on the show, go around the horn and share a last call. Just something we think might be of interest to our audience. Barr, you're our guest. Do you have a last call you'd like to share?
Yeah. So, you know, I love what you said about how this is, I think as an industry, we're growing up, and I think that's right. Good for us. One of the things that I love seeing is sort of in collaborations or sort of folks and how other folks think about data observability. And so actually we are collaborating with O'Reilly Media, who's been sort of a strong voice in the data space, on the very first data observability training course. And I think that's a real sort of milestone for the industry in solidifying how we think about data observability. And yeah, looking forward to that.
Excellent. Hey, Mo, what about you? Last call?
Yeah, so my team got into a discussion over Slack, big shock, about time on site and whether that's a good metric. And like, as you imagine,
I believe your sister has some opinions and has written about that.
I'm aware. Anyway, we have some very strong opinions that were floating around the group. And big shock, one of my colleagues, Nick, who, I mean, I don't know how he has time to absorb all this stuff, but he does. He recommended this article called Jointly Leveraging Intent and Interaction Signals to Predict User Satisfaction with Slate Recommendations, which, as you picked up from the title, is an academic paper. It is not light reading, but it's by about five people from Spotify. And the thing that they talk about, which is really interesting, is that like user interactions are really conditional on the specific intent that the user has. And so a metric like time on site could be a really good metric based on user intent. And it just kind of, it was the first time that it really got me to think about that problem in a very different way. So yeah, I'll share that link. It's like I said, not light reading, but really, really fascinating. And like you can imagine, obviously for, you know, a product like Spotify, time on site would be a really good metric. So, you know, capturing user intent really is important to nailing the right metrics.
The problem is the companies that are selling toilet paper but think they're Spotify. Like that's the... maybe, yeah, toilet paper is on site. Wait a minute. I'm not just thinking that through a little bit further. I just picked an just random consumer package good. And you know,
given 2020, e-commerce toilet paper is not necessarily the worst idea I've ever heard. So, okay, what about you?
I'm going to do a quick twofer, and this is light reading. One of them, and this has been out for a while, the OpenAI project, the DALL-E project. You guys familiar with that? It's a GPT-3 based thing of generating images from text. So it's DALL-E. It's a combination of Salvador Dali and WALL-E, the movie. But it's this interactive thing where basically taking kind of, it's almost like doing Mad Lib phrases, sort of, except they've got pre-populated options, and then it generates images, like an illustration of a baby daikon radish and a tutu walking a dog, and then it generates like a bunch of images from it. It's interactive and it's a little addictive. It's a little... I don't think it's scary. I think it's delightful and awesome. But
oh, we'll find a way to make it scary.
No. Yeah.
Anything related to Wally can't be scary.
Yeah, that's
well, the point. The message of that movie is pretty dark, honestly.
Fair point.
And then my other one is, for several years now, I've wanted there to be an R package for the version 2.0 API for Adobe Analytics. And Ben Woodard has actually successfully gotten that out. I mean, it's not on CRAN yet, but you can install it from GitHub. He's kicked the tires on it pretty hard. He's got a site built generating from package down. So basic functionality for anybody who's been using RSite Catalyst and has said, I want that for the 2.0 API, AdobeAnalyticsR.com. It's been a long time coming, but he did a great job on getting that initial beta out the door. So that's exciting for the R users out there.
That's outstanding. Now, how has Ben built in the five pillars of observability? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, funny, you had Dr. Joe Sutherland take a little bit of a code review, and there were some actually things on logging that Joe said that he was like, yeah, so putting a systemic kind of approach to logging as opposed to kind of the initial version. So I do believe there's actual, and certainly using something like R and having it scheduled to do some of the, I think, observability. I mean, I've done that in the past with Adobe data, of where I've just built my own, you know, run it daily to do basic, it would fall under, I guess, distribution and freshness type checks, but pretty crude. But so, I can take that. Your wit and I can turn it into a real thing.
That is why you, Tim, are
no.
The quintessential.
So what's your last call?
All right. Well, I also sort of have a twofer. So really quickly, the Digital Analytics Hub is a conference that comes up from time to time. It got postponed last year, but I think, Tim, you're leading a huddle in March, about a month from now.
Well, yes, I am. I believe you're leading a huddle as
and
well.
I am too, yeah. So anyway, so if you are someone who is excited about digital analytics and those kinds of things, that's always been a really great conference. It's going to be virtual this year, but they've also made the price to match. So that's a really good one to check out. And then secondly, there's a survey that I like to check out every so often, which is called it's a survey by New Vantage Partners around the state of corporate data initiatives or becoming more data driven, you know, and AI and those kinds of things. It's the Big Data and AI Executive Survey. That's the title I was looking for. Okay. Anyways, they just came out with their 2021 version at the beginning of January. It's always a fascinating read. I think the section that always I jump right to is when they ask executives why they haven't made more progress in these initiatives. And basically it's 92% culture, process, and talent, and 8% technology. And it just shows you where the imbalance is and that kind of thing. But it is actually rich of lots of great information. So it's always a good read. Whenever you're looking for, you know, surveys to, you know, shoehorn an opinion in on a group of executives who are swayed by such things, look no further than the New Vantage Partners Big Data AI Executive Survey. All right. That's the last calls. It is so this has been a great episode. I'm really excited about it. And you know what's interesting? Our episodes just get even better through the efforts of our producer, and that is Josh Crowhurst. And so, Josh, we're thankful for everything you do. Big shout out to you. And we would love to hear from you, the listener. And there's a couple ways that we would love to do that. So first, obviously, anytime you're on the Measure Slack, most of us are always there too. And so we love to hear from you that way. Also, we have a LinkedIn group and on Twitter. And Bar, are you on Twitter, or do you have a Twitter presence?
I am on Twitter. BM_data_downtime.
All right. So you can also reach out to Bar or her team via Twitter as well. So probably a good follow, because I think this will probably be something that gets talked about more and more in our industry, because we're grown up now. It's 2021 and we're kind of kind of mature.
That's how we roll.
Yeah, I feel like I did something. I didn't do anything. That's right. Anyways, we'd love to hear from you. And, you know, not for nothing, but go give us a rating on iTunes. Couldn't kill anything. Unless it's less than a 5, and then we don't want to hear. No, I'm just kidding. We do. We want to hear from you. And just do that. All right. I know that you're busy, that you're doing analysis and you're putting out reports and you're delivering all these things to try to drive value for your business. And things like data breaking and things like that does make your life harder. And I thought, you know, one way to encapsulate that is we are already paying for this data downtime. We just might not know how much we're paying. But as an analyst, you're out there doing the work. So no matter what the quality of your data today, I know I speak for my two co-hosts, Tim Wilson and Mo Kiss, when I say, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Twitter or in the Measure Slack. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io or on Twitter at analyticshour.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Analytics. Oh my God. What the fuck does that even mean?
Rock flag and five pillars. Sorry, they won't let me warn people that we're going to do that and that that's going to happen.
You have literally said, I do not want to warn people that I'm going to do that. Like, you have literally said,
I didn't say no. I have said no. I have always said, and you say, no, no, no. I think it's part of the charm.